Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
When do pumpkins start coming up in your garden?
This one's out of my garden.
It's huge, and this is July.
That's a little bit crazy.
The weird weather we've been experiencing across the Midwest has sped up the growing processes for many of the crops in Chef Daniel Orr's garden. This early bird pumpkin will be a vessel in which we bake a chicken. Before that, we hear from the folks at Harvest Public Media about mid-sized farmers who are trying to find their way in the world of large corporate or small family farms. Moya Andrews of Focus on Flowers talks about how instead of eating them, she rescues the flowers used as garnishes in restaurants. And then it's back to the kitchen for two recipes using squash blossoms. Stay with us. Welcome to Mia Partlow, who has the foodie news headlines for us. Hi, hi.
Hello there. 9 million visitors will be descending on London in the coming weeks for the London Olympics, and two of the game's major sponsors will be ready and waiting when they want a cold beverage or a snack. Coca-Cola will be the only company selling beverages in the Olympic Village, and if you're looking for some French fries, McDonald's wants to be your only option. The company has pressured Olympic chiefs to prohibit other vendors from serving fries unless they're part of a fish and chips ensemble. The prominence of companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola has angered health experts, who feel associating the Olympics, an event focused on athleticism and good health, with fast food sends a mixed message to audiences. While Coke has responded by saying it expects 75% of its revenue at the Games to come from sales of water, juice, and sugar-free beverages, McDonald's has asserted that it's not the responsibility of corporations or governments to decide what individual consumers may eat. In early July, the London Assembly passed a measure encouraging the International Olympic Committee to ban sponsors that sell high-calorie food and drinks. Realistically, though, large-scale corporate support is essential to making sure the games remain financially solvent. Companies pay $100 million for the Olympic partner-level sponsorship. Coca-Cola has been a major sponsor since 1928 and McDonald's since 1976. The London Olympics gets underway on Friday, July 27th. Foodborne illness victims, consumer advocates, and health organizations are frustrated by the lack of progress on national food safety laws. The groups wrote a letter to the White House urging President Obama to enforce safety rules. The Make Our Food Safe Coalition points to the 10 multi-state outbreaks of foodborne illnesses in the past year. They argue that had the Food Safety Modernization Act from January 2011 been enforced, outbreaks like the listeria-tainted cantaloupe would not have happened. And cigarettes aren't just bad for your health these days. Thanks to extreme drought conditions, they could also cause fires. Indiana State Police Superintendent Paul Whitesell sent a memo statewide to his agency's supervisors, reminding them to enforce laws against throwing anything burning from a moving motor vehicle. The fine for such an infraction could be up to $10,000. The goal is to cut down on the number of fires popping up along interstates and busy roads. Keep up to date on all the latest news about food, agriculture, and sustainability on our website, where you can also find recipes and interviews, eartheats.org.
And our Twitter feed and Facebook page are the places to go for up-to-the-minute news stories. Find us by searching for Earth Eats. Mia Partlow brings us the news headlines every week. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Two basic types of farms are proliferating in the United States, very big and very small. But medium-sized, self-sustaining family farms have declined dramatically. So does that mean the farmer of the future will either be benefactor of an enormous family operation or the owner of a lifestyle farm? Not necessarily. A few people are finding ways to break into mid-level production agriculture. Wrapping up Harvest Public Media's five-part series on the farmer of the future, Frank Morris spoke to one of them.
A few years ago, things were going smoothly for Eric Neal and his family.
I was a construction superintendent for a fantastic company.
Neal was making good money, traveling the country, running challenging job sites, but he wasn't satisfied.
I decided that I wanted to be a farmer. I've always wanted to be a farmer, and so we met with an extension agent and just challenged him to tell us how we could make a living off of our farm and no other way.
That is a tall order. Small farms don't tend to support themselves with just the commodities they produce. Enormous farms do, but it takes a fortune in land and equipment to get one going. The number of big operations has grown as successful producers build super-efficient mega farms. And as Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack pointed out in Kansas City a couple of years ago, mid-sized farms are meanwhile vanishing fast.
10 years ago, we had 110,000 dairy producers. Today, we have about 65,000. Everybody satisfied with those trends?
Eric Neal wasn't. He decided to plunge in, to switch gears in his mid-40s and try to make a go of it as a grazing dairyman.
Come on, boss! Come on! These girls are getting some new grass.
Neal's 120 or so cows live outside all year round on the gentle rolling pastures south of Kansas City near Freeman, Missouri. Walking a lot and living mostly on grass, Neal's cows produce less milk than their grain-fed, barn-housed cousins in megadairies. But the costs are lower, too.
It's how to get started, because it doesn't take as much money. It is that simple. A low-input business model.
As long as it rains. If it doesn't, Neal's grass withers, and so do his profits. He has to buy feed. In the milk barn, Neal works fast and efficiently, marching cows into position, feeding them, placing suction cups under each udder, dodging cow poop, treating the udders, cleaning up, and moving on. He does this twice a day.
When I'm really on my game, I can milk 100 cows in an hour by myself.
The work just about never stops around here, and the whole family has to chip in. Neal's wife, Julie Neal, looks back fondly on her days before agriculture.
You don't know what you have until it's gone. I mean, I had a really easy life.
Now, like most farm wives, Neal has chores. Lots of them. In the spring, she nurses dozens and dozens of calves, mixing, hauling, and feeding sometimes 80 gallons of formula a day. She cleans the barns, builds fences, and runs the house. She also keeps the books and sometimes struggles to make them balance.
It is hard and it's stressful, but we're very proud of what we do.
And these days, a lot more people seem to appreciate it.
Old man, sad old man, spent his life living off the land. Dirty hands and a clean soul.
I heard in it, I'm not sure which country song it was, but the line, dirty hands and a clean soul, really, I heard that and it really kind of hit me.
Callaway Neal, the Neal's older son, is heading to the University of Missouri this fall to study ag economics. Callaway says living and working on a real farm distinguishes he and his brother, Carter, in lots of ways.
It definitely has advantages. I mean, I'm known at school, and Carter is too, as, you know, dairy kids. We're the kids who sometimes leave at lunch because the cows get out, and that's a big deal.
When they're here, they really don't like being a dairy farmer that much. But when they get a mile from here, man, they are some dairy farming dudes. They are dairy farmers to the core.
And Eric Neal is hoping the mystique will draw at least one of his two boys back to the farm after college. Family's kicking around some ideas about how they might be able to market their milk more profitably in the future. For now, though, Neal's just proud to be making it in the food production business.
It's not supposed to work. It's not supposed to work. It's supposed to be a thing of the past, not a thing of the future. We're supposed to be a tourist attraction instead of a viable business.
Neal would like to see a lot more people defying a 100-year trend and stepping back into production agriculture. He'd be the first to tell you, though, that making it in this business takes planning, dedication, money, luck, and a lot of hard work. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Listen to all 5 stories from Harvest Public Media's Farmer of the Future series on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. We're in the kitchen first thing today with Chef Daniel Orr. He's prepping a dish that uses an ingredient we're not accustomed to enjoying in the middle of summer. When do pumpkins start coming up in your garden?
This one's out of my garden.
It's huge, and this is July.
That's a little bit crazy.
It's thanks to the drought and high temperatures in Indiana and across the Midwest that his garden is producing premature produce. Earlier this week, central Indiana experienced a little reprieve from the devastating drought conditions. The National Weather Service recorded almost a quarter of an inch of rainfall, which was nearly three times the total accumulation since June 1st. But that was literally a drop in the bucket. The state issued a water shortage for all 92 counties, specifically requesting that the heaviest water consumers voluntarily reduce water usage by 10 to 15%.
Okay, what do you want to talk about? Talk about the drought?
In his garden, Orr is hand-watering his crops, which involves taking the hose directly to the base of the plant. It's time-consuming for sure, but this way he doesn't lose as much water to evaporation, and he can give each plant exactly what it needs.
So as long as you're watering, and I've been watering the heck out of my garden, it still looks great, but the deer are also thirsty, and they're coming in to eat my produce. So it's been a real struggle this year.
What specifically, what plants are you noticing are having a really hard time in your garden?
Well, things that have really been sped up are the squashes and pumpkins. They're doing well, but they're way early. Things like lettuce, softer, more tender types of vegetables are struggling, and what they're doing is they are trying to go to seed, so they're bolting, which means they're sending up their seeds and flower shoots, and the leaves are getting very bitter.
Well, normally, for squashes and pumpkins, for instance, when are you going to be harvesting these in a normal year with normal rainfall and normal temperatures?
Well, the thing was we had such a wonderful wet spring, and the plants really took off and grew fast, and then with all the high heat, they seem to be ripening, and normally that should be happening in late September, October. So this year is a little bit bizarre.
Well, so then fast forward to September and October, what's your garden going to look like?
Well, in August I start planting my kales and my different autumn crops. But if it's not raining, I'm not going to plant those and just have to water and water and water. So I may be planting late for my fall crops, such, you know, into September, October, depending on how the forecast looks.
This maybe is one of the meatiest pumpkins I've ever seen in person. There's a lot of meat in here. Is there something you had to do specifically in your garden?
No, it's just the type of variety of pumpkin. You can see that it's fully matured because the seeds are nice and filled out, and they're firm, they're hard. So that means it was picked at the peak of ripeness.
The pumpkin will be a vessel inside which we'll be baking a chicken.
So I've got a nice little chicken, and then we've got some nice fresh herbs, and this is really whatever you have around. So today I've got some rosemary, some thyme, basil, scallions, and we can throw in a little bit of sage and fennel if we wanted to. So this is kind of a one-pot meal. And then, of course, you get to eat the cooking vessel. You get to eat the pot when you're done. All right, so I'm going to take this chicken and right over the pumpkin, I'm going to season it with salt and pepper, and at the same time, I'm going to season the pumpkin itself.
So, and you're not going light on the salt and pepper. There's a lot of seasoning going into this.
A lot of seasoning. Don't be afraid of flavor. This pumpkin is going to absorb a lot. It needs a lot of seasoning because it's a very bland vegetable. And then a trick that's great for any type of seasoning of poultry is take your two fingers and run them underneath the skin that runs over the breast. Okay, and you're just going to open up a pocket there, and then you can season, put your herbs right underneath there as well. And that way it's getting right on the meat. So you can see now I've got this beautiful chicken all ready to go. I'm going to pop that inside the cavity of the pumpkin. And then I'm going to add just a few more seasonings. About a cup of white wine. We've got some smoked paprika, garlic powder. And then I'm using some of my sweet seasoned spice blend. And that's a combination of about 10 different sweet spices that you might find in pumpkin pie spice blend. All right, we're going to drizzle it with just a little bit of oil, put the lid back on, and then we're going to hold it in place with a couple skewers. We're just going to run those straight down into the flesh of the pumpkin, attaching the top to the bottom. Okay, and then we've got a roasting pan right here. We're going to put about an half inch of water in the roasting pan. Put the whole pumpkin in there. And then we're going to put it in a 350-degree oven for 2 hours. And it's going to get nice and golden brown, and the pumpkin's going to heat up. It's going to steam the chicken, and we've actually got one already ready. So,
when did you make this morning? What, like, seriously, when did you wake up?
I had to get up at 5:30 this morning just to get ready for Earth Eats. So,
you know. It's not that bad. That's not so bad.
Okay, let's go find that pumpkin.
Woo, that is roasted, brown, and bubbling.
Doesn't that look good?
Yeah.
All right, and so to serve this, we're going to just remove those skewers, which are much easier to take out than they were to put in. And then you carefully remove
the reveal. Still steaming.
Pull the chicken out, drain the juice out of it, and the juices should run clear, meaning that the chicken is all the way cooked. Just taste that liquid. Taste it for salt and pepper. I think this is perfect. Pour that nice pumpkin broth over the chicken and over the pumpkin wedge. And we've got a beautiful pumpkin-baked chicken.
This cooking method results in a very moist bird delicious. See photos of the finished dish and follow the recipe on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up...
You know, flowers are so almost sacred to me, so that I've got to have them there to look at intact.
That's our resident flower expert, Moya Andrews. Much to her chagrin, we'll be cooking up two recipes using squash blossoms. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Chef Daniel Orr is prepping the ingredients for our upcoming recipes, both of which use squash blossoms plucked fresh from his garden. The host of WFIU's Focus on Flowers, Moya Andrews, stopped by the Earth Eats studio to talk to us about edible flowers. But no way will she ever eat a flower under any circumstances ever. You know, I had a daylily. It was the most amazing to pick a petal off of a flower and then to eat it. Do you have any experiences like that?
No.
I know you don't eat flowers.
Never, I would never mutilate a flower like that. I never pull a petal off a flower. I know it sounds squeamish, but, you know, flowers are so almost sacred to me, mm-hmm. so that I've got to have them there to look at intact.
So what about flowers as garnishes? We're seeing plenty of those decorating plates in restaurants these days, little flowers on the side.
I take mine home. I slip it into my purse because I don't want to be parted from it once I have it in front of me. But, you know, people have eaten flowers for centuries. Actually, herbs, spices, all kinds of plants were used to cover up the taste of spoiled food. And also, of course, they strewed herbs on the floor to make the room smell better, because so much of what was cooked, the smells remained, and other unfortunate smells also. But they were used not as a flavor themselves, but to mask other flavors in the beginning, plants. So we know that medicinally and just to make things smell better, flowers have been, and plants of all kinds have been used for centuries.
Moya, you're not going to be taking part in the eating portion of our recipes today, unfortunately, but I want to talk to you about our main ingredient. So what can you tell us about our star ingredient here, squash blossoms?
Yes. I was reading that there are male and female ones, and the female ones have a little knob where the fruit is, or the zucchini is going to develop, and the male ones are larger, and they don't have that little knob. And the writer that I was reading said the male ones are tastier. I don't like that. That sounds sexist.
Moya, we're going to have a taste test and see.
We are. We don't want to promote any one sex in terms of squash blossoms.
Thanks to Moya Andrews for humoring us. Check out her tips for growing flowers at indianapublicmedia.org/focusonflowers. Chef Orr is out in the garden picking some flowers for us to use in our first flowery recipe. It's a breakfast frittata of squash blossoms and potatoes.
Now, this is my compost, and these plants just grew out of the compost. So I've got all these crazy squash plants growing. And these you have to pick every day. They will keep several days in the refrigerator, but if you left them on the plant, they would wilt by the end of the day. So if you just have a couple plants and you don't have enough for a whole meal, you can pick them every day for a few days, and then you'll have enough for the weekend.
Do you remember composting squash? You suppose that's why these are growing?
Yes, absolutely. We take all the seeds out and throw the seeds in the compost bucket at the restaurant, and then I bring them home, and then I cover the whole compost with fall leaves. And then the next year, all kinds of stuff grows out
of
there.
Who knows? It's like a surprise garden. It's fun.
And you can see these have gone all the way up in the tree, and it's like a forest of squash flowers. All right, so we can head in and cook up some breakfast. And a frittata is basically the easiest omelet you can make, because you don't have to worry about flipping it or turning it over. You serve it right in the pan. What we've done is we've already parboiled some other little fingerling potatoes. So we're going to get those started in the pan. You can just grab me the olive oil there.
Absolutely.
We're going to let those get started. I'll crack some eggs. We'll just give those a little whisk. So this is a great dish to do on the weekends when you have some friends over for brunch. You can just crack the eggs, throw them on top of your sautéed vegetables. You could use anything really that you have in your refrigerator. Throw a little bit of cheese on there, and then pop it in the oven until it's set, and that's all there is to it. And I'm going to add a little bit of chopped garlic. So we want to cook this just until the garlic starts to brown a little bit. In the meantime, I'm going to just make sure we don't have any critters left in the squash flowers, because sometimes they hide out inside.
Well, that's protein, though, right?
Yeah. And you can leave the stems and everything right on there. All right. We're going to add our eggs, a little bit of salt and pepper. Got a little of my au poivre blend, a little bit of Mediterranean blend, which is just kind of like an herbe de Provence.
I would imagine the spice blend sort of makes this dish. Talk me through what's in both of those.
All right. Well, the Mediterranean blend is, like I said, it's like an herbe de Provence. So there's thyme and savory and a little bit of lavender, basil, a little bit of oregano. So a nice little mix of spices. And then the au poivre is just a mixture of different peppers. So I have a little bit of crushed red pepper, a little coriander seed, some black pepper, white pepper, guinea pepper. So a lot of different flavors there. All right. Now we're just going to push in the edges, just like you would an omelet. Make sure we have our potatoes evenly dispersed. I'm going to turn off the heat, and we're going to pop that in the oven with a little bit of cheese on top.
Frittata time. Let's see. Is it ready to go?
It is.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Nice, firm setup.
Pulling away from the edges a little bit?
Just a little bit around the edge, right? We'll put it over here, and I'll cut it into wedges, just like you would do a quiche. And if you wanted to, you could serve a little bit of red pepper sauce or tomato sauce with this. Just really whatever you want. It makes a perfect peasant's dish. All right. Who wants a taste?
And here's another preparation of the blossoms. Not quite as healthy as the first one, but hey, why not?
What we're going to do is a recipe that I learned in Milan from a friend of mine, Enzo. It's kind of a classic way of preparing the squash blossoms. And what we do is we just kind of open them up. They almost feel silky, and it's almost like opening up a piece of cloth. And the way we're going to cook these today is we're going to fry them. But you could also do the same recipe and just fold them over and steam them for a healthier dish. All right, next I'm going to marinate the mozzarella. I've got some nice fresh mozzarella. Just to kind of intensify the flavor a little bit, we're going to add a little bit of chopped garlic and a little bit of my new regime spice blend, and then a little bit of olive oil. We're going to wrap these in a basil leaf and then stuff them into the squash blossom. Okay, the other thing that I like to do, and what my friend in Italy showed me to do, is to also add a little anchovy. They give it that kind of briny flavor, which is really, really nice. One of the reasons I love Italian food is the complex flavors that they develop in their dishes. So now I'm just going to roll these up, okay, and then press them together. So you've made these little tight little packages.
As he's rolling the blossoms, he mentioned a good idea to me. Since this is sort of an intensive process, you can prep the blossoms ahead of time and then freeze them for 24 hours or so. That way, when your guests arrive, you can fry them up right then.
Okay, now that we have our packages made up, just going to crack a couple eggs and just put a touch of water in there. And this is what in the business we call standard breading procedure. All right, so you have your flour, your egg mixture, and then your breadcrumbs. Okay, and then you line your three pans up. Your first one should always be your flour, your dry ingredients. You always want to season that with a little bit of salt and pepper. And then one thing that people always do is they always get their hands all gunky when they're doing this kind of thing. So what you want to do is have a dry hand and a wet hand. All right, so with your dry hand, you're going to do your flour, and then you put it into the egg, and you just repeat that until all of them are done. Okay, then the final process in the standard breading procedure is the breadcrumbs. We're using panko. Okay, once they're all nicely coated, we're going to go over to the stove and just simply saute them up. All right, so we have probably about an eighth to a quarter of an inch of oil in here, and we're just going to gently put them down inside. So we want to cook them long enough that the mozzarella or mozzarella inside has time to get warm and melt, because that's what it's all about, is that nice gooey mozzarella on the inside and the nice crunchy breading on the outside.
Almost finished. Make sure you have some paper towels handy to soak up the oil, by the way. It's really a very pretty dish. Check out photos as well as the complete recipe on our website, eartheats.org.
All right. So to finish a plate, what I'm going to do is just take a little bit of red pepper sauce, a little roasted red pepper sauce, and then I'm going to decorate it with one of those wonderful wine-cured anchovies, and then one of these beautiful purple basil sprigs on the top. That, to me, is an Italian summer.
Out of curiosity, I wanted to see what summer in Italy was actually like. So here's a snapshot of their weather forecast for the next several days. Looks like generally temperatures in the mid to upper 80s, with 40% chance of rain showers on some days. Why doesn't that sound nice? Check out photos and recipes of both of our squash blossom dishes on our website, eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga, more at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week on Earth Eats, our recipes focus on the color green. Tomatillos for a salsa verde, and cucumbers for a refreshing gazpacho. Be sure to come back for that. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.